Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Baker's Inn, Charlie, that is, in the 2014 race for governor. Emily Rooney and Peter Kadzis join us to dissect his candidacy on day one. Then the man who brought sports concussions out of the dark, former Harvard football player, pro wrestler, and research pioneer Chris Nowinski, talks head injuries from Pee Wee Leagues to the pros.
Then the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory, assesses the Boston mayor's race, Charlie Baker's chances as governor, John Kerry's performance on Syria, then survival tips for your college freshman, and everything you need to know about the new fall TV season, from Breaking Bad to Mad Men to Homeland to a new Michael J. Fox comedy. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to 89.7 Boston Public Radio, WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So the phalanx of Democratic candidates running for governor, now as a Republican challenger, Charlie Baker, officially tossed his hat into the ring with this video posted at 10 a.m.
Care about being a good husband to my wife, Lauren, and a loving and responsible father to our three children. I care about our community, where we've raised our family, and being a good son and brother. And as corny as it may sound, that's exactly why I want to be your governor. I care about this great state and the wonderful people who make it strong and call it home.
Well, that's the first part of the video. We'll play more in a couple of seconds. We've seen Republicans run this state before. Could it happen again in 2014? Joining us to go over this gubernatorial news are WGBH's Emily Rooney and Peter Kadzis. Emily and Peter, hello there.
Hey, Jim.
Hey. Hi, you guys. Okay, Charlie's video came out at 10 o'clock this morning. It is now a little bit past noontime.
How many times did you watch it?
Well, I watched it twice, Emily. It's not the whole campaign, but what do you think his chances are?
Oh, you're going right toward his chances? Oh, phew. I'm glad you didn't ask me about
the video.
You want to trash the video? Trash the video.
Well, I mean, for my money, it was very, very schmaltzy. He used the word corny. I think it was schmaltzy. It was extremely low-key. It wasn't all that personable. And this is one of the things that he was criticized for the last time around. I mean, he tried to make it, you know, very family oriented, and it had an upbeat, you know, let's aim high, let's be great Massachusetts, as opposed to, you know, we've had enough, which is have you haven't had enough, which he was doing the last time along when he was running with against Governor Deval Patrick. But something's going to have to change dramatically for him. We all like him. We should just get that out there.
Yes, I mean, we do.
He's
we
a
do.
Regular
he's a
on
guy.
This program. He's a terrific human being. He's a great leader in a sense. He's never been a great candidate, so I think he's going to have to move pretty far off that video to make.
So, Peter, Emily obviously liked the video a lot. How did you feel about his kickoff?
It was, well, the words abject failure come
really
to mind.
That?
It was, you know, as a white guy's version of yes, we can, I would say it was a failure. I mean, he's kind to his wife. What candidate for governor is in favor of wife beating? I mean, what candidate for governor kicks his kids? I mean, come on. Part of it here, though, and maybe it's not Charlie's fault, I think we should begin by blaming his advisors. This whole trend of candidates announcing via video.
I'm with you.
Or Twitter.
It's politics light. You want the man or the woman in the flesh, in front of people, doing it for real.
You know, it's interesting because the content of that first 20 seconds we played is what I think he needs to talk about, because it is who he is. We've gotten to know him pretty a lot.
He's a great guy.
On these Tuesday things, but as relaxed and funny as he is here on Tuesdays, that's how stiff this thing was.
Well,
and by the way,
it takes a certain you're on television all the time,
easy.
Emily. You do your thing at Fox News in the morning. Some people can get up and be casual and relaxed and stroll around the backyard very easily. Some people can't. He can't. They shouldn't have chosen that for his opening because that is not his forte. It's just not his forte.
But I agree with Peter, too. Why not just have a press conference, face the music? A lot of these candidates at this point, we know, Jim, because we complain about it all the time. They want to run as far away from the media as they can.
Charlie,
so
will be with us
it.
Tomorrow, we should say, by the way. So, but yeah. I generally totally agree with you, as you know. it's video, it's limited access to media and that sort of thing.
But you know what? I don't think, and see if you guys agree with me or disagree with me, I think the video is going to fade fairly soon. This campaign, I think it's going to be about, is it time for Massachusetts to have another Republican governor? We've had, or we will have had, 8 years of Deval Patrick. There have been some scandals in the Patrick administration. There have been some indications, you know, that one-party rule has been not the best thing in every instance for Massachusetts. So is it time for another Republican? He's a social liberal, fiscal conservative. What do you think?
No, I agree with you. I think several weeks ago, Scott Lehigh wrote a very good column about how Deval Patrick was being sort of too removed and above it all and a little bit twerky about issues.
Twerky.
Yeah, it was a polite word. I almost said something else. I think that Charlie Baker has to just make people feel comfortable with him. Mm-hmm. I think there will be a natural desire to have a change. Listen, Beacon Hill is very unpopular. Deval Patrick came in as an outsider. He leaves as the ultimate insider. Charlie Baker, I think, has a chance to, like, talk sense to people in Massachusetts. This video didn't do it, but
you're right on something. And I think that I actually believe this, that this state is very forgiving.
Yes.
We forget things, that horrible things people have done. Like Ted Kennedy.
Just to
begin with. And running a bad campaign, people forgive you for that. They forgave Martha Coakley. And I think there's a genuine sincerity that people like Charlie Baker and they want to embrace him. But, you know, I felt like sort of a wash and a reminder of 3 years ago when he was running against Deval Patrick. His speech pattern, just everything about him is so unnatural.
Emily, let's get that. Do you think he should pull out today as a result? I mean, it is now. He's been in the race for 2 hours and 12 minutes.
He's got a
is
darn
it time
good chance
to get
of
out?
Winning. That's what I was saying. He's got a darn
you know,
good chance
one
of winning.
The issues was the anger. It's a variation of what you're thinking. He, Deval Patrick, Tim Cahill, did a debate in our radio studio in our former jobs. The story in the Globe the next day was about, is Charlie Baker too angry to be governor, because of some, he was fairly demonstrative in that debate.
I believe took off his shoe like Nikita Khrushchev and started pounding the table in the middle of the studio.
Well, actually, we asked Charlie about that when he was with us several weeks ago, and here's that conversation. Do you remember what the Globe headline was the next day, which led to that being the discussion about you for at least the next week in the campaign? Remember what the headline was?
The whole thing about me stamping my feet about the Common Core and education reform.
Right. Is Charlie Baker too angry to be governor?
You didn't stamp your feet.
No, that was the way it was portrayed.
Oh, okay.
You did actually slam
you
the
shoe.
You did slam the table. You did. You slammed the table.
It was a Khrushchev.
What'd you do?
Moment.
What'd you do?
Yeah, I took off my shoe and I pounded it on the table.
See, by the way, that is exactly the kind of self-deprecation that if I, you know, listen, by the way, he's got expert advisors. We read he has a Democratic advisor. Yeah, Will Kaiser, who worked for Ted Kennedy, and Marty Meehan is doing his communications, I assume, responsible for this video. I would have done a little deprecating humor. I might have even quoted. In fact, let's play this. Scott Brown, when he just said on Dan Ray's show a couple of weeks ago he was not running for governor, said he endorsed Charlie Baker wholeheartedly, but then he couldn't resist taking a hit at him. Here's Brown.
Yeah, listen, he has executive experience. He's thoughtful. He's a good family man. Listen, is he Mr. Personality? No. All right, everyone knows that. He's not.
Thank you, Senator Brown. I would have made fun of that. You know, some people say, I am not Mr. Personality. And make a little fun of yourself. That's the way you loosen yourself up, Emily Rooney, isn't it?
And I think that's the way you appeal to a broad base, too. I mean, this is corny in a way that I just – and it's repetitive, too, from what we heard 3-4 years ago when he ran. It just feels – like it was a lot of the same, even though he kind of took a different approach, which was, you know, let's be great. You know, tried to take a high note as opposed to have you had enough.
You know, one of the obsessions I have, which is a variation of what Marjorie said before, Peter Kadzis, is this one-party rule deal. You know, there are obviously people who are so hardcore, I'll vote for any Democrat, that it doesn't matter. But it seems to me if you're not in that category, and he echoes the Mitt Romney line of whatever it was, 2002, I can't remember what year it was, whatever year Romney ran, the gang of three. Do you really want the House controlled by Democrats, the Senate, which now only has three Republicans, by the way? Essentially, I can provide a check and balance. That's a pretty powerful message, isn't it?
I think it's incredibly powerful. I mean, Beacon Hill in Massachusetts is reviled universally. He doesn't have to appear as an outsider. He should say, look, I've worked up there. I know what it's like, you need a change. He should set himself up as the agent of the people, as the taxpayer's friend, not as some raging Republican. Here's an example. Last election, he talked about laying off 3,000 workers. Most people's reactions, I said, look, unemployment was high. They said laying off 3,000 workers is going to make unemployment less. Instead, he should have presented it as saying, look, as taxpayers, we're getting killed here. You know, don't go after the state workers. Instead, look out for the interests of the taxpayers.
When you say by the way, you know what's interesting about that? You see the Globe story this morning suggesting that unlike his last race against Deval Patrick, he apparently will not be taking a no-tax pledge,
yes,
which is a significant sign that he's trying to move to the middle in this race.
But Peter Katz is a variation on that. I think it's really dawning on people in the private sector now who are not going to be able to retire because they have no pensions. One of the things he can talk about, and it's a problem that's breaking the bank all across the country, including in Detroit, which has gone totally bankrupt, is the idea of early retirement. I mean, that is a beautiful thing for him to, because it doesn't really pick on anybody. It says you can retire at 55. Maybe you can't collect your stipend until you're 65, or you have to work till you're 62 or something so that the Massachusetts doesn't go broke. I mean, that's a taxpayer issue I think has become very visceral to people because, of course, most people have lost their pensions. By the way, Paul just emailed from Milton. It says Charlie Baker has to do something immediately. He has to stop saying, at the end of the day.
Oh, yeah. I agree with that. I'm interested, though, in the Democratic field. There's some stellar and unusual.
Can you name them all?
Well, I can't know because I have
Don't look at the list.
Don Berwick, Joe Avalon, Juliet Kayyem, possibly Martha Coakley, Joe Curtis-Tony, you know.
How about Steve Grossman? He's the treasurer. Remember him?
Yes. Mike
maybe Dan Wolf.
No, there's some very, very good people.
Maybe who?
Mike Capuano.
Mike Capuano. There's some really stellar, strong people in that group. I'm dying to know whether Martha Coakley is going to throw her hat in.
Well, you know what's interesting? I hope she doesn't. I mean,
I
hope she doesn't. I think she's come back really strong from her defeat. She's been a really good attorney general. But attorney generals just cannot be elected governor.
And district attorneys before that. There's a long history. Riley, Scott Harshbarger.
You get blamed for those you prosecute, and then you blame for those you don't get prosecuted.
By the way, Will Kaiser ran Tom Riley's.
That's right. That's actually right. And when Riley was the runaway favorite, obviously, in the campaign that Deval Patrick ended up winning. You know, one of the interesting things about Coakley, we should say, we've invited her on the show repeatedly lately on the EBT thing and something she did last week, my apologies. And her PR person, her communications person, oddly has told Chelsea, our lead producer, she will not be doing any appearances until she decides if she's running for governor, which is sort of odd since
that.
She is the attorney general and she's acting as the attorney
general.
She
can only just say to you, I haven't decided yet, Jim, and then move on to the next
thing. But doesn't that suggest, at least to me, and maybe that she is doing this race, even though it's getting a little late in the game?
Well, here's what's going to be fascinating if Martha Coakley does get in. You know, there are many women in Massachusetts. We just elected Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts as our first female senator, but Martha Coakley ran before, didn't get in. You know, the women's vote is going to be a big issue. And, of course, Charlie Baker did terribly among women the last time around, so he's got to court the women's vote big time. So Coakley-Baker race could be a ferocious chase after.
And interesting, that would be a fascinating, you know, pair up, you know, the two kind of like profound losers going against each other. Well, seriously.
Ooh,
and, you know, the fact that we would elect one of them, and that sort of goes with what I was saying about being, forgiving in a sense.
You know, Juliet Kayyem, I mean, when it was revealed that she was going to be running.
Former Homeland Security advisor to both Deval Patrick and Barack Obama, and did some CNN work around the Marathon and the Globe columnist formerly.
I noticed on social media the huge preponderance of women, you know, not necessarily media or civilian women, who were just so excited the idea of Kayyem. I think the women's vote and women's issues are going to be a huge
part. Peter Katzis, I generally agree with you, but when you have a mayoral race in the biggest city in Massachusetts where there are 11 men and one woman, and the woman, by virtue of that alone, is not leading the pack, it suggests to me that that's a factor, but not as big a factor as you and I seem to think.
It is, but she's also, I hate to say it, not a very good candidate.
Charlotte Gullerich, we're talking about.
Not a very good candidate.
We're talking to Peter Katzis and Emily Rooney about the announcement that Charlie Baker made this morning via video that he is running running for governor in 2014. Apparently, his mentor, as he's called in the Globe, Bill Well, will be making some statement on Baker's behalf today, and Charlie will join us tomorrow on Boston Public Radio.
You know, I don't buy this, but other people have said it repeatedly, and it's in one of the Globe or Herald pieces, I forget which one I read this morning, that Charlie Baker is going to be hurt by the right-leaning nutcases in the Republican Party
nationwide.
I don't see that happening in Massachusetts, but I may be wrong. What do you think, Peter Katz?
I think that's a real danger. One of the problems the last time around was he folded in that wacko, you know, right-wing rhetoric into his persona. He cannot sound like a national Republican.
Yeah.
And I think it's very hard because I think Charlie Baker, the individual, can. I'm not sure that his Republican advisors can filter that crazy stuff out.
And he didn't take the high road on that Republican Governors Association attack on Tim Cahill. He could have. He could have repeatedly said, I'm not backing it, I'm not supporting it, I'm not behind it.
Good point.
But he didn't.
Well, one of the great embarrassments, I would say, of any set of campaigns, do you remember when the lieutenant governor candidate for Tim Cahill, anybody remember his name? Paul Lascoco announced one day that
totally
he was no longer running and endorsed Charlie Baker. I say I don't think Charlie appeared with him physically, if I recall, but I would have said, listen, stay where you are.
Exactly.
I don't want you. But then, you know, let's get back to this, because we've been trashing this video to different degrees. Let's step back to the candidacy for a minute. If you were to ask me to create the dream candidate in many ways to be governor of Massachusetts, you'd create a socially liberal, which he is.
Which he is.
Fiscally conservative.
Which he is.
Which he is, guy who has fixed things. I mean,
he's still
tall and handsome. You're still going to have to deal.
And he does have a lovely wife and family.
He does. Lauren's terrific. He's got these kids that he apparently dotes on. I mean, he talks about them all the time, and I think it's totally sincere. And you say to yourself, he did fix Harvard Pilgrim. In fact, I don't know if we have that piece of the video. Let's play another piece of the video this morning, but one of them, and it may not be in here, he mentions that the thing was about to go bankrupt, and now it has the highest ratings of any healthcare plan in America. Here's some piece of what Charlie had to say in the video.
Let's rise above the politics. Here's an idea. Bipartisan leadership focused on growing our economy, making state government more affordable, accountable, and business-friendly. Promoting small business and seeking a true partnership with our cities and towns to ignite their economies and create jobs. I can do it because I've done it before.
Sounds like he's on Valium. I mean, it's just, it's so slow motion. It's like slowed down.
The message is slowed. I mean, the delivery is slowed down.
That's what I meant.
But that message itself, I think, is potentially powerful.
I totally agree.
I mean, he has done something. The turnaround at Harvard Health and, you know, was a remarkable thing.
Well, you know what else is he's really smart. I mean, we've had him on many times. The conventional wisdom, remember we were talking about early childhood education? Mm-hmm. The conventional wisdom is early childhood education is going to raise everybody's grades, going to make the kids perform better in school. We were talking about that with Charlie Baker. He said, no, you're absolutely wrong, Jim and Margie. You don't know what you're talking about. And then he deluged us with all these studies saying that exactly that is not necessarily true. There's a little bit of bump and then kids go right back down the slide. I mean, that is one of the things you hear over and over and over. Charlie Baker is the first person that came to me with data that said just the opposite. And he does that on many occasions. I remember when he was working for Bill Weld, and I used to do a lot of stories about child welfare in Massachusetts. He was incredibly knowledgeable and would call you back and tell you everything that was right about what you said, everything that was wrong about what you said. And he has a grasp of issues that is really quite impressive. And they're kind of out of the box thinking. And I find that attractive about his candidacy as well.
And he also thought, which is an idea that we've embraced on the show, that we should have one casino and see how it goes before we do
absolutely.
Three and a Native American.
Was
casino.
He right?
No,
or was
well,
he right?
Well, we don't know yet, but I think it was a good. So let's talk about the Democratic field for a minute. Now, Emily was honest enough to admit, Peter Katz, that she couldn't name them all unless she had her little green eye. Yeah, she's got a little card here. Assuming that, well, with or without Coakley, who's the person who you think is the most formidable Baker challenger on the Democratic side?
Well, I would say of the announced candidates, I think Juliette Kayyem would be, untested though she may be. I think if Capuano enters the race, I think he becomes very formidable. I mean, he's the embodiment of soul. Grossman, however, has a lot of support among rank-and-file activists. On those occasions when I'm at, like, an official dinner or soiree with political overtones. You know, you meet guys, you know, from Fall River who are active in the Democratic Party, and they love Steve Grossman. You know, I've met people from Worcester who are active in the party who love Steve Grossman.
You've actually met people from Worcester.
I have.
Yes, he goes to everything.
He does.
He's one of those, shows up at all the charity events. He's extremely generous. He's going to be able to fund his own campaign to a part. You know, we are all very familiar with Julia Kayyem. We've all known her for years. Mm-hmm. She's, and my guess is that to the vast majority of people, especially outside of the Boston circle, she's a total, you know.
Exactly, but
know who she is.
I agree, Emily. But so was Deval Patrick at one point. Maybe I'm overly. I could well be overly enthusiastic about her. I just think that what Charlie Baker has is, you know, he's a regular smart guy who has the potential to appeal. What she has is the breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. And the challenge for both of them is how do they leverage those positives for themselves.
Yeah, do you see my sense? I have no data, nor do I have I spoken to anyone that suggests there's truth in this. However, I believe it is. Do you think Julia Kayyem would have even gotten in this race if she had not been told by a semi-reliable source that Martha Coakley was not? This gets back to the woman thing. I mean, I find it really hard to believe that a relatively unknown but talented 40-some-year-old Kayyem would enter this race.
No, I think
if
she,
the Bigfoot in this, Martha Coakley, decided to do this.
I think she has a tremendous amount of self-confidence.
Kayyem,
and didn't even take that into consideration. You know, she got a lot of FaceTime during the Boston Marathon bombings.
Yeah, she did. She's great on TV.
She's extremely attractive.
Very attractive. She's got three kids,
about,
I think.
Talk about knowledgeable.
Yep.
I mean, somebody who, you know, is not making it up on the fly.
Can I tell you something? By the way, I love that you've said what you've said in the last 20 minutes. Marjorie is the only other person besides you, Emily, who is willing to acknowledge that how one looks, for better or worse, actually matters
in American politics.
It's just one
of Steve Grossman's problems.
It is one of Steve Grossman's problems, and I think you guys are being ridiculous. Look at anybody who
rises. I wasn't saying otherwise. I just don't have the courage to say what you both say.
But it's definitely true. I mean, you look at anybody who rises above selectman or mayor. I mean, if you're a statewide office holder almost anywhere in America now, it's a television entity. You got to look pretty good.
Well,
on
look
television.
At presidents. Essentially,
yes.
Post Richard Nixon,
we haven't had a bad looking president.
You really have not had a bad looking
president. And he wasn't bad looking.
He was not good looking.
Yeah. Let's I don't know if he would have been on The Bachelor. Yeah.
You're being
like
very
that.
Christian today.
Well, I mean,
but you know what I think about Kayyem too. I think. I mean, where'd you go to college?
Harvard.
Okay. I mean, Charlie
she's
Baker.
She's a double Harvard.
Yeah. She's a double Harvard.
Harvard.
I'm not sure that a Democrat double Harvard after Deval Patrick necessarily plays in the hinterlands. There's a lot of people that worry about the bloated Democratic machine. I think that's going to hurt her, that idea that she's going to be too far to the left, too Harvard, too much of that sort of intellectual kind of
you know, we should do
person.
In the spirit of fairness here, which we embrace not often enough. We should mention the two people who we just mentioned the names of for people. Don Berwick served as head of Medicare and Medicaid for Obama for a brief period of time. He is running. And this Joe Avalon, who I have not met.
I've heard really good things about
Avalon.
Him.
He's a former selectman
here
in Wellesley.
He's a surgeon.
Something. Yeah. He's been an executive in pharmaceutical companies and had something to do with
Blue Cross Blue Shield. But I've heard good things about him.
But you just don't. It's early in the race, so you don't.
I've met both of them. By the way, just in passing, but they're really smart. They're also incredibly idealistic. They really want to make a difference, but I just don't know how they break through.
Yeah, but how good-looking are they, Peter?
I mean, no. Hey, I see. I missed the point. I get you.
So Charlie Baker's video is out at 10 o'clock this morning, as I said. Bill Weld apparently is going to speak at some time this afternoon, even though he's been fairly hard to get a hold of. Have you had a hard time getting?
Impossible.
Yeah, so have we. And it's pretty odd, particularly if he's going to be a surrogate to some degree.
Nobody
Baker,
responded to us today.
Nor to us.
You know, the other thing I was thinking about in this whole race, too, I don't think there's going to be another Republican that's going to come forward. Maybe they will be, but I doubt it. So Baker has the whole time to run sort of unopposed, whereas he's
not necessarily a help.
Exactly.
Because the press isn't going to pay any attention to him.
Not going to pay
any
attention to the Democrats, if there's five of them or four of them, however many end up actually running, you know, scraping it out and being in these primary debates. You wonder how much that's going to hurt Baker not having to get out there over and over again in these debates.
Well, it depends on what he does.
But then he's going to have a lot of money.
Baker will have enough money.
Yeah.
I mean, the issue is maybe the smartest thing. I'm saying maybe. I'm not a political strategist. But how about if Charlie Baker just, you know, quietly went out across the state and just met a whole lot of people, you know, pressed a lot of flesh.
Yep.
He's got a long time, and retail politics do matter.
Well, by the way, he could meet every single enrolled Republican this weekend. So
that's exactly the scenario that Scott Brown faced, because Martha Coakley beat out like eight people.
That's right.
In the preliminary, in the primary, and everybody thought, oh, poor Scott Brown, he doesn't have time to really get his act together, and boom.
Yes, and he also is not going to have to squander the money on the primary. He's going to be able to save all the money for the general election. And you could see that, where in a personal one-to-one kind of thing, he could do very, very well.
Okay, so do either of you, before we leave, do either of you want to apologize for what you said about the video earlier in this segment? We'll start with you, Emily. How about you?
I didn't think I said anything that bad.
You didn't. How about you? You said something really bad, Peter Katz. What did you say?
It was tough love. I mean, someone's got to tell him the truth.
Yeah.
Peter Katz and Emily Rooney, great to see you. Thanks, both of you guys.
Thank you very much for coming in. I think you said abject failure. I think those were your words, Peter Katz. And two losers is what you said over there, Emily. not to give you a hard time. Okay. With the NFL season officially starting tomorrow, and with the Broncos taking on the Ravens, we're going to look at the darker side of the sport with Chris Nowinski, the founder and co-president of the Sports Legacy Institute. We're going to talk about at the NFL, concussions, ESPN, and what we can do about kids in sports. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Tomorrow, as you know, marks the official start of football season with the Broncos taking on the Baltimore Ravens. But if there was ever a sobering way to kick off the season, it came by way of what people are calling this historic agreement between the National Football League and roughly 5,000 former professional football players. They reached a $765 million settlement over these concussion lawsuits. Joining us to talk about what this means for the future of football and for football players at all levels, from peewee to the pros, is Chris Nowinski. He played football at Harvard. He wrestled. Yes, he did. Is Chris Harvard in the WWE. And most importantly, he's the founder and co-president of the Sports Legacy Institute. Chris Nowinski, it's great to see you again.
Great to see you, too.
Yeah, thank you for coming in, Chris. So what do you think of this $765 million settlement? Do you think it's enough money?
Well, that's a very big and loaded question, considering, I've come a long way in this world from being the thorn in the NFL side to now they're funding some of our work. And so, you know, it's hard. You know, $765 million is going to go very quickly, considering how many people are out there suffering with this, with some sort of long-term care. And so I hope that everybody's happy that was party to that settlement.
Obviously you are in a little bit of a weird situation because of your NFL connection now, but the basic criticism was not just about the money from those who did criticize it, but that there was no admission of wrongdoing on the part of the NFL, and also no discovery, meaning the ability to get inside the documents and see, did the NFL know what risk they were putting football players at when they chose to throw them back in the games? I assume you're hearing, I mean, you're in touch with virtually every wife of a man who was a star or a player and who subsequently died as a result of this. Is there that kind of talk you're hearing, Chris Nowinski?
Yeah. I mean, I agree. Everybody wants to know, you know, what the NFL knew and when, and would love to see what they would find in discovery. And I think that, you know, that is one of the things that, you know, I'll always now be curious about. Because, again, you know, for me, you know, it was when I started reading the medical literature in 2003. I mean, it was a black and white case that we needed to stop what we were doing. So I have to imagine that somebody else knew that who was somewhere in the NFL.
You know, speaking of the wife, just for one second, last year you were nice enough to ask me to MC your annual event, which I'll be doing again in October. We can tell people about this later for what you and Dr. Cantor do at BU at the Sports Legacy Institute. The wives who spoke there, including, was it Sylvia Mackey, who's the wife of the former star John Mackey for the Colts, their stories about what they lived through with their husbands after they were these celebrated athletes making a ton of dough for the Times, and then the incredible suffering they had to live through as these men began to fall apart and die, is just, it's amongst the most powerful stuff I've ever heard.
Yeah, and that's hard to put a price tag on for a guy to become from a great man to basically a monster to his family. I remember I was watching Outside the Lines this weekend, watching old footage of Dave Duerson's son, who I know, talking about how eventually they all got scared to bring home friends because dad would just flip out on their friends. and beyond the violence that comes with a lot of this with CTE. So it's ugly, and frankly, we just, you know, that's why, you know, we keep pressing ahead on the research so hard so that we can eventually diagnose this and treat it, because, you know, money's fine, but it you know, take away someone's soul, it's rough.
Well, I just read this little piece in the Globe over the weekend. They had an editorial about this Colin Finnerty. He was just 30 years old. You think of most of these guys, it takes them a little bit longer than that to get to such a dire strait. But tell people who don't know about this Colin Finnerty, who died of pneumonia and choked to death.
Right. The most decorated quarterback in college history, in the sense that he was a Division II, won 50 games in his career, 3 national championships, got a cup of coffee in the NFL, but never played it down. And, you know, was one of those guys who just would run through people. He was a big quarterback and took a lot of hits to the head. And at 30 years old, he was starting to have some mental issues. And then one day goes off in a boat on his own to go fishing and misses his father-in-law on the pickup and goes wandering into the woods and has some sort of a breakdown, who knows, but eventually ends up choking on his own vomit, and they just find him dead in the woods.
From the CTE they think, right?
Right. I mean, he was having neurological issues. There was also some issues about pain, and he was on some medication. So who knows? But the idea was he had a very advanced case of CTE for someone at 30 years old.
Exactly.
Dr. McKee diagnosed him stage 2, and just to think that this is a quarterback. They're not supposed to be getting hit in the head so much.
Our number is 877-301-8970. The reason we wanted Chris in here primarily was obviously to talk about what was in the news with the NFL, but one of the great things you do is work at all levels. And if you have calls about your own kid who is involved in contact sports and what protections he or she can engage, what progress is being made, we're going to ask Chris about that in a couple of seconds. Please give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. You know, tell us your personal history. You played, you were a linebacker at Harvard, right?
Defensive tackle.
Oh, excuse me. Defensive tackle. Chris is a fairly big man, I should say. You were a defensive tackle. Were you all Ivy or something, am I right?
Technically, yes. Second team all Ivy.
Whoa, excuse me. All these caveats.
You
got to be honest.
We'll take it. That's okay.
Okay, and then how did you go from a second team all Ivy defensive tackle, by the way, and to become Chris Harvard in the WWE? How did that happen, Chris Nowinski?
I ended up at the wrong consulting firm. I was doing life sciences consulting for Trinity Partners, which is out in Waltham. The owner of the firm, John Corcoran, just had a lot of friends in wrestling from some of his old jobs. And over one lunch, he just goes, you know what? This job is great for you. It'll always be here, but I think you'd make a great pro wrestler. And you mind if I make some calls? And he ends up calling the manager for the Four Horsemen, a guy named J.J. Dillon, who's now a senior guy at WCW back in 2001. And says, hey, I got a guy for you. And so they fly me down. And Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff beats me up for a couple of days and says, hey, you know what? You should stick with this. So eventually I end up at Killer Kowalski's wrestling school. And
you
WWE.
Stuck with it. And the sad part of the story is you don't just talk in the abstract about concussions. You live this. I mean, that's how you got. What happened to you? What did you experience, Chris Nowinski?
I got a concussion summer 2003 at the Hartford Civic Center. Bubba Ray Dudley kicked me in the head. And I didn't know what a concussion was or why I should care about it. And so I lied for 5 weeks through a throbbing headache and nausea and kept getting
hit. Because you didn't
want
to be taken out of the ring, essentially, right? Not making your money or whatever it was.
Exactly. Yeah. Wouldn't be getting paid. So I kept going, not knowing it was causing me any damage. Made the concussion so bad that when I finally stopped, once I developed sleepwalking and hurt myself, jumping off of a bed, acting out a dream, by then it was too late, and I had 5 years of headaches and the nearly constant and sleepwalking almost every night. I was heavily sedated every night. It went, you know, depression and memory problems. It was rough, but it was during that time that, you know, I started researching how to fix myself, realized I couldn't necessarily do that, but I could help others.
Our number is 877-301-8970. It's Chris Nowinski again, played football at Harvard, former wrestler in the WWE, and now one of the leaders of the Sports Legacy Institute that's doing groundbreaking work on concussions in sports.
So I'm looking across you, Chris Nowinski. You look good, but you have you're welcome. But you have a chronic problem here, correct?
Yeah, you know, it's hard, you know, again, because we can't really diagnose it, this long-term degenerative disease, I don't know what's happening inside my brain, but I do know I'm a guinea pig in a lot of our studies at Boston University, and I'm not normal, I'll tell
you
that.
You're not
normal.
No. Do you still have the headaches?
I still have headache problems. I don't feel like I did 10 years ago. I think I sense that there's something going wrong in there.
Uh-huh.
But when you but you not is you're not having this every night disaster that you were when you were just a few months out of this concussion.
No.
So there's some sense your brain might have healed a little bit.
Right. I've recovered from post-concussion syndrome.
Okay.
But the question is then, usually it's about like 10 years after you stop getting hit in the head that symptoms of CTE would start showing up. And it usually starts as things you can't really tell. It's small behavioral changes, personality changes, impulse control problems, which I would qualify for in some ways. And then maybe in another 10 years, it comes my memory starts to go and my emotional control really goes. That's usually the course you see. So right now, hopefully my executive functioning is fine and I can still, live a normal life.
Can we change gears for a second? The story, I've known you for quite a while and I've followed your work for quite a while. The story that put me totally over the edge was, I think it was last year, in the Tantasqua Pop Warner Football League. This was a situation where one team is getting beaten at some point 28-0. And by the way, under the rules of Pop Warner, you're supposed to call the game at 28-0. Well, they didn't call it. They kept playing until it was 52-0. Five of the 10 to 12-year-olds suffered concussions in this Pop Warner thing. And the message to the likes of me, who knows nothing about this, this is an epidemic at every single level. So I guess that leads into the question we got here for, Chris Nowinski. What's being done for kids who are not going to play in the NFL, who are not going to play pro soccer or pro basketball, just normal kids who like sports? What progress are we making?
We're making dramatic progress. I think the easiest one to point to is there's now laws in 49 states requiring that you can't go back into the same game. Massachusetts was the sixth state that had that. You can't go back when you've had a concussion. You have to be educated. There's actually a hearing on September 10th to advance that law down below the high school level into private schools. And so we're really hopeful that will pass. We're now starting to require to educate our coaches. We never used to educate them on concussions or even, at the youth level in many places on football. And so you'd have parents meaning to do well, but doing drills and having ideas that are old and outmoded, like, the same kind of ideas that you couldn't drink water in practice 30 years ago. They're telling kids to suck it up. I mean,
do coaches want to be educated? I know that's a horrible generalization. I know a lot of wonderful people who care a lot about the kids that are under their care. But don't just as many just want to win, regardless of what?
There's always the problem of parents living through their children. I mean, but there's also enlightened folks out there. I mean, I just trained 300 coaches. Central Mass Pop Warner made it mandatory for coaches to come listen to me go on for 2 hours. So
good.
It's happening.
Good. And I've got to commend you because from the time I first knew you and we first spoke about this, I have noticed just from my own friends with kids and stuff, there are so many more schools now that when you get a concussion, you can't go back and play again. And these are public schools. I don't know about private schools until you pass these tests.
What happened to your son? Your son was playing basketball, right?
Yeah, two of my three kids have had bad concussions, but there's a great degree in concussions because one, my daughter playing soccer was fine in a month and a half. My son was out for a year and a half because he got a very bad concussion, but they wouldn't go back, let him play basketball again. It kind of ruined his basketball career, but until he passed this test. This is at Brookline High School. And
what do they do now? Baselines
before
you start?
They do a baseline test before the season. So you take the test. And it's things like identifying triangles and identifying spots, how fast you can do it, until you can do it at the level you could before you get hurt. You can't play. And I had no idea, I'm embarrassed to say, when he got hurt, what a big deal a concussion was until I was referred to these experts on it that said, you gotta lay low. You can't go. You can't go on rides at Disney World. You shouldn't even fly in an airplane. You shouldn't watch television. You shouldn't play. All these things you couldn't do. Who had any idea? I had to go to a specialist. So I commend you, Chris Nowinski, because the world has changed dramatically.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's exciting to think that kids won't have to go through what I went through because we're not paying attention.
How about this? Before we get to the calls, we have a lot of them at 877-301-8970. The 300 coaches you train, what did you say, just recently you did? Pop Warner level?
Central Mass Pop Warner.
Obviously, this is anecdotal. I'm sure you didn't talk in depth to all 300 of them. Did most of them or did virtually all of them want to protect their kids? Or even at this, I'm sorry to be a cynic, but I mean, based on this 10-score thing, what they cared about was winning. They didn't give a damn about the heads of the insides of the heads of their kids. Most of them are not like that. The vast majority are not like that. They want to do the right thing. I hope the answer
is yes. Yeah, no, coaches sign up because they care. Remember, these are volunteer coaches not being paid. It's not necessarily always the most fun to keep all these kids focused on learning football. So, no, I think the issue is we've just never given them the tools or the philosophy to understand how damaging a concussion
is.
Because they're not bleeding. They're not complaining. So what's the big deal? And so unless you are actually taught, you're not going to take a concussion seriously.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, to bring it back home on the professional level, Ted Johnson, who was actually at your dinner last year. I mean, tell briefly the story of what Ted Johnson lived through with Coach Belichick and where Ted Johnson is today.
Yeah, Ted Johnson, you know, I met him when he was in the dark days of post-concussion syndrome. He'd gotten a concussion with the Patriots, and what he said was he wasn't cleared by a doctor yet, hadn't seen him, but he was asked to go back into a drill that week during practice when he wasn't recovered. Got another concussion a few days later on an unrecovered brain, which can be exponentially worse, and then had symptoms the rest of the year, and then by the next season just couldn't play anymore because his head hurt too much. He was in a very dark place when we met. He's doing much better now. You know, he's actually doing national radio now for CBS.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's great.
He's got a sports show. So.
Well, he got in a little bit of trouble making a comment about one of the current Patriots. We won't get into that. Yeah.
And just one quick question before we go to the calls. If your kid does come home with a concussion, there's a great variance in knowledge about this. So what do you recommend? I mean, just should they go beyond their own pediatrician? Should they find a specialist or will they get...
They should ask a lot of questions. I would recommend seeing a specialist because we're getting slowly better at training your average doctor on what to know. But, you know, I have a friend who's going to medical school somewhere in the state. I won't say where, but who came out, was a grad student in our lab at BU. And he was taught in medical school just a few weeks ago. You have to be knocked out to be to have a concussion. That's what the professor was teaching in a medical school.
This is at a medical school?
In the state.
Yeah.
So there's still people who don't know. So I would recommend seeing a specialist or asking a lot of questions to ask when your doctor was trained on this.
And not to just listen to the people at the school, because as good as they are, they may not be experts. That was my experience. I had to go to a specialist, and it was night and day between what the specialist told me, what the school told me, and what, regrettably, my pediatrician told me.
Yeah. We're joined by Chris Nowinski in studio. Are you the co-director of the Sports Legacy Institute?
I'm the executive director of the Sports Legacy Institute. I'm the co-director of the Center for the Study of Traumatic Encephalopathy at
Terrific.
BU.
Well, I got your position wrong at Harvard. I got your position wrong, whatever.
It's okay.
Close enough. Let's take some phone calls at 877-301-8974. Chris.
Let's go to Sandy from Norton. Thanks for calling, Sandy.
Thank you. We really enjoy listening to you every day and
Thanks.
Really appreciate your efforts.
I'm
calling specifically. I have a 14-year-old. She just went through her ACL tear, which happens 9 times more with girls than with boys, we have learned. But I'm specifically calling about soccer and girls. And right now I have my kid wear that headband, which if it's a minor protection, it's a minor protection. But I'm wondering if there is any protection for these kids as they play tons of soccer, for them to be wearing something on their head. And if you have any ideas there.
Good.
Thanks,
thank
Andy.
You. Good question. Part of the problem is if you look historically at the sports we added helmets to, and that would be football and ice hockey is the best examples, the games got actually more dangerous for the players because what you did is you took away their incentive not to put their head into dangerous situations because you took away pain and blood. So one of the big problems with helmets is they don't do a good job protecting against rotational forces when your head twists, and they never will. So the reality is they're not doing nearly as much for you as you think, and you might incentivize your child because they don't feel that pain anymore on their scalp put themselves in more dangerous situations. So I'm actually anti adding helmets or headbands for protection to any sport that doesn't already have them. I think the real future is we've got to hit them in the head fewer times. It's a novel concept. But, I just spoke last night at the Shipley School in Pennsylvania, and a mother came up to me afterwards after I talked about we have to monitor headers, we have to limit the number of headers we do, especially in practice, and said her 13-year-old daughter yesterday had a 90-minute just heading practice with the goalie just punting the ball as high as they could, which is just insanity.
So, well, they're not going to take that out of the game, though. They're not going to take headers out of soccer, right?
Well, no, you don't have to. It's one of those things that we need to have a better discussion about at what age you introduce headers, because, you know, there's just no reason to be hitting a six-year-old in the head hundreds of times as their brain is developing.
God.
Yeah, but even though we do it. And then there's the question is, well, what level is safe? There was just a study done out of Mount Sinai, New York, using a very advanced MRI that actually found differences in the physical structure of the brain of soccer players once they started getting over, that number was like 800 and some headers a year, that they started to see actual physical changes to their brain.
So what are you saying? Wow. So you're not even crazy. Sandy mentioned that they've done this limiter protection. I hadn't even heard about it before. These protective headbands, you're not even into that because you're concerned that it raises this, it lowers your well, say it again.
It creates incentive to put your head into more dangerous situations.
Because you think you're protected more than you are. Okay.
Right. You try to avoid hitting each other in the head soccer.
Right, and you don't have pain nerves in your brain, so you're not going to feel your brain bouncing around.
Sandy, thank you for the call. Let's go to Angie in Medford. You're on with Chris Nowinski. We're obviously talking about concussions in sports. Hi, Angie.
Oh, hi. I, too, enjoy your shows every
day. Thanks.
Thank you. I am actually very interested in this. I have a son who lives in New York. He's 34 years old now. And when I realized he's been playing soccer since he was four. But he's played very intensely most of his life and even got to the semi-pros. But in recent years, I would say in the last 5 years, he's had very persistent headaches. Jokingly, everybody always talked about him having narcolepsy. Well, lo and behold, he got diagnosed with narcolepsy. Mm. He seems to have what we kept thinking were more like symptoms of like ADD, as if he were like back in 13, you know, this distractibility, impulse control, job losses, kind of all sorts of things like that. All kind of out of character for him. But we knew he had concussions, at least four that I knew of when he was a child. Who knows as he got older. But he also had things where he had a fracture of an eye. He had a fracture of his jaw. And never was screened with those types of injuries for what was probably also a massive head jolt during those times. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering now, with 30 years of playing soccer, where would he go to get tested or screened, and what kind of treatment would there be available at this stage of the game, and is something like narcolepsy related?
Wow, good question. Hard question. I'm sorry to hear about these symptoms, especially, you know, kind of appearing late. It's unknown without examination, but this is often the profile of people we do hear about with CTE when we look at their brain 20, 30 years later when they pass away. Their family says they might start changing in that sort of way. Unfortunately, there is no treatment for it, although you can treat the symptoms. So you could give him medications to help attention disorders, concentration, that sort of thing. But there's no CTE treatment center even out there. I would recommend, you could reach out to our staff at the center.
How do they find you?
Yeah, online at bu.edu/CSTE. Shoot us an email. We'll see if we can get you to somebody locally who knows, who understands this and is focused on it. And
bu.edu/CTSE?
CSTE.
CSTE, yeah. My apologies.
No, sorry. Yeah, it's hard. The other one is sportslegacy.org. Email me through there, and that's easy to remember. Sportslegacy.org. In narcolepsy, who knows? There's been so little research on CTE that it's really hard to tell. So I would say reach out to us. We'll try to help, but we really need to advance this research so we can help more.
Thank you for the call, Angie, and good luck with your son. Chris, you just mentioned a few minutes ago that hockey is more dangerous now with helmets. I mean, I always thought the Bobby Orrs of the world were nuts without their helmets. That's amazing.
Well, it's a trade-off. So they added helmets because of the risk of skull fracture.
Right.
There's one very serious injury where someone hit their head on the ice. And so they thought, we'll add helmets because helmets do a good job preventing against skull fracture. But what that changed, if you talk to any old-time hockey player, and I just ran into Lyndon Byers an hour ago, we were talking about this. You know, people didn't hit each other in the head when you didn't have helmets on because it hurt. And
right.
they would complain. They'd get angry because they'd lose a tooth or they'd get bloody or, you know, so... Basically, when you covered up those injuries, you opened up the door to everyone just throwing elbows up and hitting each other in the head. And that's why it's so important they're policing that now down through, like, Brendan Shanahan with the NHL so we don't hit each other in the head.
You know, before I get back to the Coles, you mentioned your first concussion in the WWE was when some character kicked you in the head. Who was that again?
Bubba Ray Dudley. That was my last
concussion. Should we assume that despite what many of us think, that wrestling is real? Is that what that is? That it is?
Wrestling is really dangerous.
Okay,
is what it is.
Let's go to Beverly in Sagamore Beach. You're on with Chris Nowinski. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Read your book, Chris, and great that you're raising awareness. I had a couple of quick questions. This legislation that's pending, can we and should we call our legislators to support it, and will it include all contact sports?
Yeah, it will include, you know, and I can't say I have it 100% memorized because I'll learn the day before we go in there. But yes, I would say reach out to your state representative, let them know you support the bill. I wish I had it off my memory which one it is, but it will cover all sports. It'll cover all athletes in the state. The idea is it would cover through schools. So right now it's just public high schools that are required to have the education and the no return to play. But I think it gets down to all schools, which is very important.
If you call 617, is it 722-2000? Marjorie,
722-2000.
You get the state house. Even if you don't know the names of your state rep or senator, just say where you live and they'll find it for you. By the way, the book that she was just talking about, and Beverly, thank you, is that really started this movement in a lot of ways. Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis, which you wrote, what, 6 or 7 years ago?
2006, which I updated last fall. So it's actually now a new edition is out
Head
there.
Head Games, Football's Concussion Crisis. You should get the book. People rave about it.
Rich from Taunton, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. I'm with Chris Nowinski.
Thank you for addressing this issue. Why do you think there's such a massive gap between what state athletic commissions do for boxers that get concussions and the difference between that and what the NFL and even college organizations do for players that get concussions?
That's a great question, and it has a lot to do with when you play the games or have the matches. And in boxing, you know, if you get knocked out in the ring, you have to take a specified time out of the ring, which is sometimes 30 days, sometimes 90 days.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and that's because you don't need to fight every Sunday. And you know, the reality is it's a much safer situation for your brain. And the more studies we do, the longer we're learning people should be out with concussions. It may be 30 days in a few years. But you play football every week, and so that kind of rule it would be impossible to put in. But it's interesting you mentioned college. I didn't mention this to you. There's a study that came out like 2 or 3 days ago by the Chronicle of Higher Education, actually reaching out to a survey of athletic trainers at Division I football programs. And the big startling things were two things. Because now that the NFL is kind of settled, college is the new focus of players that have no one to fight for them, and they're really getting mistreated. And it turned out that about 10% of the athletic trainers actually worked for the coach. They didn't work for the athletic director of the school. So the coach could fire them. And they had multiple instances of coaches just firing their trainer because they were holding athletes out too long for their injuries. And then 50% of them reported being pressured to return people faster because the coach is making so much money. And of course, that didn't happen in my experience. You know, at Harvard, you know, Tim Murphy is the most ethical coach out there. But at the big time schools, it's a real risk.
Thanks so much for your call.
You know, I wonder, Chris Nowinski, I was reading this morning that a former Boston College linebacker, Ron Perryman, died at 42 from Lou Gehrig's disease. So what is the thinking about the relationship between Lou Gehrig's disease and hits in the head? Do we know?
Well, yeah, we're learning, and that's thanks to some brilliant work by Dr. Ann McKee, our neuropathologist, who when she started looking at the brains and spinal cords of athletes, it was originally 2 football players and a boxer. Now we have over a dozen. She runs our brain bank, but she also runs the National VA ALS brain bank. So there's lots of different ways you get to ALS. It's a clinical definition of the disease. It's really motor neuron disease. And basically she identified that one way to get to these symptoms, these motor symptoms, appears to be through getting CTE. Some people get CTE, it really becomes a motor problem for them, and they develop ALS. And that's why a recent study came out saying that NFL players had a 4 times greater risk of developing ALS.
When did you start doing this? When did you start lobbying, crusading, whatever you want to say? How long have you been in the
right after
concussion?
He got kicked in the head by Bobby Doe Joe right. Dudley or whatever his name was.
Yeah. In the fall of 2003, when I met Dr. Robert Cantu, who's our medical director and my mentor, he opened up my eyes to the problem.
Yeah.
And the book came out in 2006, so we put together SLI in 2007.
Well, I just want to say again, the difference between things before 2003
Amen.
And the difference now is just incredible. And those of us who've had these bad situations, I mean, it's your work that really pushed a lot of these schools to stop, to treat concussion seriously. And parents like myself, I had no idea. I came from the old school where you had a concussion. Oh, you went out for an hour. You came back and played the game. Who knew?
Yeah, well, you guys are too kind.
No, I'm serious.
I'm not. Now, Chris Nowinski, if people have questions, they go to sportslegacy.org. Yeah. Also, if they want to either contribute or go, what date is the event again?
It is Wednesday, October 23rd, and we can't wait to have you back hosting at the Boston Harbor Hotel for the 6th Annual Impact Awards.
Can I tell you, this very briefly about this, only make the pitch because it is a fabulous event. You think about something so sobering, it's going to be down. One, you do meet families who have lived through this, which is as moving as it gets, but there's a huge amount of fun. A lot of pro athletes. Last year, Kevin Falk was there. Taylor Twellman was there. I mean, a whole bunch of pro athletes, basketball players, that sort of thing, coaches. It's a terrific event. Sportslegacy.org. And Chris, I agree with Marjorie. You're doing great work. And
plus,
thanks so much.
There's no one who can MC like Jim Brown.
Oh,
Chris
my God.
Chris Nowinski, he's unbelievable.
Okay, fine.
Crushed the live auction.
Chris, it's
absolutely
great to see you. Yeah.
Chris Nowinski, thank you so much for being here. He, of course, is the founder and co-president of the Sports Legacy Institute. Great to talk to you. Chris, as always, when we come back, we're going to look at sharing the blame when it comes to texting and driving. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Yesterday, Nancy Kane, who's a professor at Harvard Business School, joined us on Open Mic. And she offered this homily to start the new year, said we should watch a couple of videos. One of them was a video entitled From 1 Second to the Next by the great German director Werner Herzog about what happens when you text and drive. Just listen to a piece.
I was texting back and forth with my wife. I was texting, and I think I was reading a text back at the time of the accident. Because I remember driving and, like, my head just snapped up when I saw, you know, the windshield just glass broke and screeching and my head, you know, it happened in about a second. And I mean, I had 1,000 thoughts going through my mind. As I started coming to a stop, I saw, you know, a body come down from off the top of the van. And I just thought, oh, my gosh, what have I done?
From 1 second to the next is the name of the video. It's 30-some minutes. You really have to see it. So from Werner Herzog and Nancy Kane, we all know we shouldn't text. But a New Jersey court has come up with a decree quite recently that said if there's an accident, not should the driving person who's driving and texting be liable, but if a person texts to the driver knowing that he or she is driving, they should share in the blame. And we want to know what you think about that expansion of our law at 877-301-8970. If you know that Marjorie Egan is driving a car, for whatever reason, you know, she left the studio, she texted you and told you she's about to get in her car, and you choose to text her anyway, and Marjorie Egan gets in an accident while she's reading your text or texting you back, should you share in the liability? I have to say, I am so there. If you can prove that that person knew that you were driving, I am so there, it is insane.
Well, I've become sort of a texting maniac.
Anti-texting maniac.
Yeah, I used to think it was okay to text at red lights and you could text at stop signs, but you do realize you just can't do it. I mean, the time it takes for you to find that little letter on your phone and to type it in. So I would be with this too. I mean, I think if you do know, and people do this. You know, I've been in the car driving down to drop off one of my kids somewhere. I'm in the car for 3 hours or something like that. I say, oh, I'm in the car. And all the people that do text me, I think you're one of the chief offenders, Jim, on that text.
No, actually, can I, in all seriousness, for that we joke about this, I am really a reformed texter. Long before Werner Herzog's frightening 32-minute video, I mean, it is horrible. And the reality is even though, and we have to say, one of the few things I'll give us a smidgen of credit for, we lobbied for an anti-texting law. We were, dozens of states did it before we came into the fold. Massachusetts finally did it, but it's virtually unenforced for a variety of reasons in defense of the police, because you don't know if someone's making a phone call, which is perfectly legal, or they are texting. This would add a burden on an additional set of people. Not only can you not text while you're driving, you can't text to somebody while they're driving. The more people who are drawn into that cocoon of potential liability, the more likely it is that people get religion about this thing, even if it's only because of finances or potential financial liability. I love the idea. We want to know what you think. 877-301-8970. Should we expand potential liability to a person who texts to another person whom they know is driving. And by the way, I'm not sure of this, but other than this New Jersey court that issued this verdict here, and this was in a case where a couple was hit by a teen who was texting and driving, and they sued both him and the teen girl he was texting with while he was driving.
Right. And the girl was cleared in the case, but the judge was saying, as the priest points out, that if you know someone is driving, don't text them or you could be deemed electronically present and may be held responsible. So, I mean, there's a high burden there, but I think the message is great. It's like we always talk about this, how Mothers Against Drunk Driving changed the whole attitude about drinking and driving. No one thinks it's a joke anymore. Nobody jokes about having one too many and getting behind the wheel of a car. It's viewed as a horrible thing, as it should be. And many young people, it's amazing how many young people you hear about, they do have designated drivers when they're going out for a wild night. This would be the same sort of thing. It would put you in a further place of saying texting is a bad thing. But you know something? How many times are you driving when you stop at a light or you see someone, they get their phone right in front of them? I mean,
forget stopping at a light. There is no place you can drive where you do not look to your left and right, where at least one of the two people, if not both of them, is texting. It is staggering.
And it's not just young people anymore. I see middle-aged people doing it now, too. I mean, as the oldsters start texting like the kids do, you see grown-ups, 40, 50, 60 years old, behind the wheel, texting.
Can I tell you, I am a believer in scaring people straight. And if you were on the fence right now saying, I know I shouldn't do it, but I do it, take 32 minutes and 48 seconds tonight and watch Werner Herzog. Just Google it from 1 second to the next, and trust me, you won't do it again. 877-301-8970. We only have a couple of minutes here. We go to Brian McGorry of the Globe. Let's take a couple of calls. Paul from Stoughton. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi. So my question was, how do you feel about emails? Because I know you're talking about texting and if you know someone's driving, but what about emails?
I think my understanding is I think emailing is covered while driving is covered by the law that was passed a couple of years ago, but I'm not 100% sure. The argument, though, whether it's covered or not, the problem, the escape clause, for lack of a better expression, is making a phone call. And there is a move that has not gone very far because the cell phone companies are pretty powerful to basically say everything should be hands-free, even though I know Marjorie's going to say now a lot of the studies show that hands-free is not much safer. So, Paul, email covered or not, the out is you can say you're making a phone call, and that's why most police officers don't bother to stop anybody.
Well,
thanks for the call.
I also think the emailing while driving is not the problem. The problem is texting while driving. I've not heard of a case, and maybe I just missed it, where there's been someone who's
If you're emailing,
obviously emailing.
You ever email from your phone?
Yeah, it's terrible. So? But I'm just saying that doesn't seem to be the issue. That's not what everybody's doing. Everybody's texting. They're not emailing. At least they're not emailing enough.
Yeah, but it's one of these things. Obviously, we live in, a lot of the phone calls that are probably online right now are from people in cars. But let them do it hands-free. Essentially, there's no – and if you can't wait to text or email, pull over to the side of the road. Ryan and Mashpee were asking if the people who text drivers who know they're driving should also be held liable. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how's it going?
Great.
I'm going to have to completely disagree. I send a lot of text messages to people,
yep,
and I know that they're not going to read them for hours later. And it's kind of like a way of leaving a message. So I think it's totally on the driver and nobody should be texting and driving.
Well, Ryan, let me use myself as Exhibit A. As soon as I feel that little vibration, it is really hard, and I think I speak for a lot of people, it is really hard not to open that text. So while your expectation may be that people like Marjorie, who probably will wait an hour to see your text, is the norm, I'm sorry. I just, I'm not there. Ryan, thanks for the call.
I think there's a pretty high standard, though. In this case, they were going back and forth. The driver that called the accident, the girl that was texting, they're going back and forth and they're texting. So, it wasn't just leaving one message. It seemed to be a conversation between the two of them via text.
But what's the harm? I mean, Ryan makes a decent point. I use texting for the same purpose he does, to sort of leave a message so you don't have to do voicemail. Because one of the most terrifying things, you call a phone number hoping to leave a voicemail. What happens? They pick up and you actually have to talk to somebody. Doesn't get much worse than that, does it? And that's the beauty of a text. But, them's the breaks. If it turns out they're driving, then you just wait. And Ryan, let me be clear, unless a prosecutor under this Jersey court decree could prove that you knew as a texter that the person to whom you were texting was driving, you're perfectly, perfectly clear.
Let's
thanks for the call, Ryan.
One more call, Jessica from Newton. What do you think, Jessica?
I think that the point is kind of being missed. That it's that the person who is emailing or texting or calling is not in control of what the other person is doing. And you could just as well, from behind the wheel, answer an email or answer a text. Is the person standing on your stoop going to be responsible? I mean, you answer your back door, you answer your phone. It's the responsibility of the driver, and the driver should not be texting or emailing or anything else.
But you're aiding and abetting the driver if you know. And again, you have to prove you know.
It's a high standard.
If you know that the person to whom you're emailing or texting is driving, then why shouldn't you wait too? What?
Because this is the way that the world functions now, and people leave each other messages and emails, and they send each other things when it's convenient for them. 3 o'clock in the morning, whatever. You don't have to answer your email at 3 o'clock in the morning, but I can leave it for you, and you can get it at 7 a.m. And that's the way the world functions now.
Well, if you email me at 3 a.m., I'm answering it immediately, Jessica. Let me tell you, that's the way I operate. You know, just to give a little bit of background, this piece of legislation, this distracted driving thing. Again, we were really dragged kicking and screaming in Massachusetts. We were late to the game. Remember, in that same legislation, Marjorie, is where Beacon Hill finally, quote, dealt with older drivers, and we ended up with the weakest testing program on older drivers in the United States of America. They just don't like taking on these driving issues, at least in my opinion, as strongly as they should.
Okay, that's enough for that. When we come back, it is time for Open Mic with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday on Open Mic at about this time. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. Hey there, Brian McGrory.
Hello, Jim Browdy. How are you?
Great.
Hey, Brian. Great to talk to you. So, Brian, I got to know your reaction. I'm opening up my Sunday New York Times magazine, flipping a few pages, and there's Tom Menino, the mayor of the city of Boston. What'd you make of that?
It was interesting. He was in the Wall Street Journal the day before. He's suddenly National Tom, you know.
And now he's in a big Herald's got a story today. He's in a little snit with the mayor of Detroit after Tom Menino said he'd blow the place up and start all over and complain about how they don't answer police calls before 90 minutes, et cetera. Does he have to go out now to Detroit and apologize?
Well, you know, you guys have made good hay with this, but look at the mayor. Our mayor has a point that things aren't working well out in Detroit, which is why the city is in so much trouble. Of course, the mayor of Detroit, former NBA star David Bing.
David Bing.
That's right.
He has a point too. What is our mayor doing talking about blowing up cities? I mean, this is crazy. So the two of them
in the wake of the marathon is where we go. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. So the two of them should go have lunch, settle this out, and the funny part is, Menino might be able to play a helpful role out there if somebody were to ask him, but he did kind of step in at this time.
So what does he do? Speaking of Menino, what does he? They ask him in that piece in the New York Times, how about being an ambassador? He says something like, that's not me. What does Tom Menino do? There are very few people I've known in public life who you say you just can't imagine them not being who they've been, meaning mayor. What does he do come the end of his term?
Well, look, we know he's writing a book, so he'll finish that off, and that will be published, I assume, sometime early next year. Can't you picture him, and I have no info, but can't you picture him at a university here teaching kids? I can't imagine taking notes in his class, but teaching kids and perhaps, you know, playing some sort of role where incoming mayors, newly elected mayors, come to symposiums or seminars here, and he talks with them. I mean, look, the reality is, in an era of hyper-partisanship where the divide has grown so much wider, he is a guy who has put all partisanship aside and just governs the city by touch and feel with no real ideology. I mean, his ideology is basically a devotion to trying to get things right.
Yeah, I love that idea. And actually, you know, parallels what they do at the Kennedy School with the incoming, the freshman senators and congresspeople every term. You know, Brian, this morning in the Globe, you have about 74 articles on the Boston mayor's race. And I'm glad you did. What's it been like trying to responsibly cover a field that is so huge? 12 candidates, 9, 10, 11 of whom are serious.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and it's been a real problem. And I think our Metro staff has done very, very well at this under difficult circumstances. I mean, as you point out, there are 12 declared candidates. You know, I would say no less than 10 of them are credible.
Yeah.
Maybe 6 to 8 of them are perfectly viable. We have gone out of our way to try not to place them in tiers, T-I-E-R-S. We, you know, look at it, it's a crowded field. It's a congested field. Anybody in September can break out. We don't know yet who is going to win this. And anybody who says they know who's atop the pack right now, they're crazy, because you know how these things work. Somebody gets momentum in the second week of September, and they emerge. Look what's going on in New York.
Well, the guy right who is at 43% after coming out of nowhere. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
So we don't know yet what's going to happen. So look, we're trying to do two things at once here. We're trying to get people information on who these candidates are. You're doing it as well at the Herald, Marjorie. We're also trying to keep up with the rhythms of a campaign, which are somewhat arrhythmic because of how crowded it is. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on out there every day, not all of which is particularly interesting to readers, but we're trying to cover this so we don't miss somebody emerging, so we don't miss somebody screwing up or doing very well. And it hasn't necessarily been an easy thing to do just because of the number of candidates in the race.
We're talking with Brian McGroy, editor of the Boston Globe, about the mayor's race. You did have something interesting today, and I've been struck, as many people have, during this race, how no one wants to annoy Tom Menino, John Conley, who's doing quite well. I don't want to say tier, but he's probably in the top tier because he does well in the polls. Anyway, he came out first before Menino announced he was not going to run, and Conley's been more critical of Menino than anybody, and he's also taken on the teachers union. But Bill Walczak this morning, I thought it was amazing that he would take on the firefighters, who were sort of sacrosanct. You guys in the Globe did this series, of course, Brian, that said that only 8% of their calls have to do with fires. A lot of them are to do with, you know, car accidents and heart attacks and stuff like that. But Walczak, it's interesting. He's going to run again. He's going to ruffle some feathers here, and there's not been much feather ruffling by anybody except Conley and Walczak to date.
Well, this has not been the first time that Bill Walczak has come out with something that, compared to the rest of the field, is counterintuitive. A few weeks ago, he came out and said, why is it we're just accepting the fact that we're going to have a casino here in Boston? Why has that been dictated to us? What good is a casino doing us? We put that in the top of the front page because it was so different than what anybody else in that field was saying. The reality is Bill Walczak is out there saying a lot of very, very interesting things. He doesn't have the strongest geographical base upon which to run, but he's a really, really intriguing candidate who's saying some very interesting things, and we're trying to reflect that in the paper.
You know, I haven't spoken to you for about a month on the air, but last time you were here, I asked if you could name all 12 candidates, and you were honest enough to say you couldn't. I'm not going to ask you again. Don't get nervous. But Marjorie and I had a discussion on air yesterday, and admittedly, this is anecdotal. I think the vast majority of people who are not wedded to a particular candidate in Boston are not into this race because it's almost impossible to follow, despite the best efforts of you guys. Marjorie thinks they are engaged. Where do you fall on this, Brian McGroy?
I think they're getting engaged. How's that for splitting the difference?
It's fine, I guess.
I think they're getting engaged. I think that, look, there's been a lot going on in this city in the last few months, you know, between the bombings and the Aaron Hernandez story and the Whitey Bulger trial. I mean, we are in a dizzying news period. And politically, we've also been through a very, very busy time with the Senate election. We had a presidential election last year. We had a special election, 2010, 2011. It's just been a really, really busy time. People may not have been as focused on this in the spring and through the summer. I think people are coming back to it now. I think that people are realizing this is an important decision. We haven't had an open election like this in 20 years, and you know, some say 30 years, because Tom Menino was the acting mayor at the last open election. So I think people are coming around to it now. And look, at the reality is, why do we need year-long campaigns in this day and age? Why can't we have a good, hard one-month campaign to get to the preliminary and a good two-month campaign after that, or a month-and-a-half campaign? I think this is sufficient time for people to focus and make the right choice.
Well, of course, now they're going to focus on something else, because Charlie Baker is going to run for governor, and he's a Republican. I wonder, Brian, what you think. I mean, we've had Deval Patrick in office. It'll be 8 years by the end of his term. Is it time for another Republican? We have a long history of electing Republicans in the corner office.
We do. I mean, we, you know, as a state that tilts left, we have We have often elected Republican governors, Bill Weld, Paul Cellucci, Mitt Romney most recently. Look at Charlie Baker's. Does Jim have a crush on Charlie too? Or
hey, it's,
I think
the
he
way,
does have a little one.
My relationship with Charlie Baker is between me and Charlie Baker, Brian, if I may.
I think it's in the early stages, I think he's going to rev it up during the campaign.
He is 6'6", I have to say.
He's Jim's height.
But go ahead, Brian.
I don't even want to think about this.
You brought it up, not me.
Are they texting buddies yet?
Are they
at that level?
Jim was upset when I told him that Charlie Baker had answered my text before he answered Jim's text.
Oh,
and it did not go down well.
That's the type of thing that will throw Jim into stone-cold silence for days.
You know,
Brian, my take on this Baker thing, I've only said this about 4,000 times on the radio, so let's be 4,001. The most effective thing that Mitt Romney did when he was running against Shannon O'Brien was talk about the Gang of Three. Unless you are a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat or someone who's likely to vote for a Democrat, you're sort of in the middle kind of thing. Here, one of the great unenrolled. If Charlie Baker says, do you really want every single branch of government controlled by Democrats, meaning the House, the Senate, over there are only three Republicans in the state Senate right now, isn't that an incredibly powerful argument to somebody who's a fence sitter?
It's a powerful argument provided you can show what went on when one party controlled all aspects of government.
That's true. That's true.
You need to be able to say, here's what happened that didn't go well, and here's what I can fix by putting me in there. You know, Charlie Baker's a really intriguing candidate. He happened to run, and maybe I'm not supposed to say this in this role now, but I did say it as a columnist then. He happened to run a really mediocre campaign last time around. He was the angry guy on the stump. It seemed like an act. It wasn't particularly authentic. And everybody was wondering, why is this guy so angry? He's, 6'6". He looks great. He's been given a lot of things in this life, a lot of gifts. Why is he acting mad? He followed a conservative playbook that didn't match the particulars of Massachusetts. And you'd like to think that he learned some lessons back then that are going to be applied to this campaign now.
Well, you know, the conservative issue, we discussed this earlier, may be a function of having Cahill in the race. And I have to say, I disagree with you. I don't think he ran a fabulous campaign. But when you're running against somebody like Deval Patrick, who really can do it on the campaign trail, by comparison, you always look.
And also, you can't forget Tim Cahill. Tim Cahill got 8% of the vote. And that is more than what the difference was between Deval Patrick and Charlie Baker. So it wasn't like Baker got totally trounced.
Yeah, but you're assuming that, I vehemently disagree with both of you on this. You're assuming that Baker would have won every Cahill vote. I don't think that at all.
I don't assume that if Cahill wasn't. He's right. I mean, that point is true. He would have had to win all of Cahill's 8%.
I'm just saying it wasn't trounced. I mean, I don't think he was trounced. But you know something? I think it would be interesting to see Charlie Baker the second time around, because Deval Patrick, I think a lot of us have been impressed. He's an extraordinary politician. Baker had run for selectman before this. He hadn't run statewide. He was kind of the golden boy of the Republicans. I think he learned a lot last time around.
I mean, he's been with us every single Tuesday. Obviously, that won't continue. And he's been totally relaxed and, I think, funny. You know what they used to say about Al Gore, as stiff as he was? You ever were in a room with Al Gore, one of the funniest guys ever. But the issue is not what he's like in a private setting or on a one radio interview. The issue is, what is he like on the campaign stump? And that's where Charlie's got to pass test. Marjorie, don't do this.
I just want you to know that Jim has been texting him advice.
I have not.
Here's the deal. You guys are trying to mask a basic truth here. Didn't he lose like 48 to 42 or something like that?
Right. And Baker got, I mean, and Cahill got 8%.
Okay, let's move on. Now, Brian, speaking of columns, you mentioned yourself as a columnist a while ago. There was a columnist in your paper who wrote like a 30-part series last year on the $200 million man at Liberty Mutual. Do you remember that series?
Vaguely.
Okay. Actually, it was you, and there were about 8 parts. And you talked about how Ted Kelly, the outgoing CEO, made $50 million a year for 4 years. You talked about their gilded offices and the private jets and all that sort of stuff. Beth Healy did a follow-up a week or so ago in your paper, putting it in the context of what you had written and the fact that they were cutting the pensions of their employees despite making almost $1 billion in profits, getting a $46 million taxpayer-funded credit. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that because I know you're in a weird spot. I will ask you to comment on this. The next day we wake up, the only politician who decided it was worth raising the issue that the taxpayers helped fund that company through this tax break for the new construction was Rob Consalvo. Why is everybody so scared to wade into these things?
It has boggled my mind since we did that, since we wrote those columns, or since I wrote those columns last year. You remember we talked about this virtually every Wednesday morning.
Yes, we did.
Time, and
it was
great. You had your friend, Governor Patrick, on, and I think his quote was, "Ted Kelly is a friend of mine," amid all of this. And
that
I, you know, give
correct.
Him give him an A for loyalty, but the fact he wouldn't speak up about corporate excess, which leads to this extraordinary pay inequity in this country, income inequity, which is a real pivotal problem in America today, really, really pivotal. It's as worse, it's as bad as it's ever been, and it's leading the country to very bad places. I don't know why people won't speak up about it. I don't know if it's because they're getting campaign contributions from these people, which they are. I don't know if it's because they're just afraid to speak out about kind of corporate lords in Boston. I don't know.
Well, you know, when you have this kind of thing, though, when you have the excess that you documented so well, the heated hangars up there, the tarmacs, you know, the what was it, the 4 million plus renovation of the guy's office?
Four and a half.
Okay.
Who's counting?
And then I think they only used it for a couple of months before they moved across the street. How long?
Well, no. So let me straighten that out. So they did, as far as I know, and it was the new CEO David Long who did the $4.5 million renovation on his 1,338 square foot office.
That's right.
Not that I remember these, but. Do you know what Tiger's Eye is? It's some sort of gemstone, I think.
Don't know.
Burled American walnut. But anyways, not to bring up the
that was in the office.
Not to bring up the $770,000 in woodwork in the office. But David Long, he's the new CEO there, and everything I've heard is that he is controlling this kind of corporate excess to, much better than Ted Kelly ever did. He's not paid nearly as well as Ted Kelly was. Granted, he's still making a lot of money. I think it was close to $10 million last year. But he's actually in the process of putting new members on the board of directors who are you know, relatively impartial, at least. And he's got a handle on this in a way that I don't think Ted Kelly ever necessarily did.
Yeah, but let me just end that sentence by saying it's one thing to say that he has reduced the excess in terms of the CEO, but he's also ultimately responsible for the decision to slash the pensions and related benefits of his own people when their profit is almost $1 billion a year. So
yeah, you said that, not me. But
exactly.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, but maybe Brian got some results here because of these endless articles about Liberty Mutual. I would say that Brian McGroy got some results. Okay, our former United States Senator John Kerry has been all over the news, of course, in this tragic situation in Syria and whether or not we're going to do the limited military strike or not. I wonder what you think of his performance. It's a totally different role. He took some criticism for fumbling the so-called boots on the ground question.
Big time, I would say.
Yeah, he did, you know, assuring lawmakers yesterday that we were not going to have U.S. troops sent in to fight on the ground in Syria. But how do you see him in his new role?
Look, I think it's been fascinating to watch because he has been so much more potent on this issue than the president himself, to the point where, you know, if and when, and let's assume it's when, we do launch a military assault on Syria, I mean, this is going to be inextricably tied to John Kerry. This is basically Kerry's Kerry's effort here. The speech he gave was at what day was that?
Friday.
Was Friday.
Yeah.
Was really powerful. It was scripted. It was well delivered. He has been out front on this. It's not that Obama has been weak by any measure. It's just Kerry has just seemed that much more zealous. And I say zealous in a good way, not a bad way. You know, yeah, he did have that fumble up on Capitol Hill. That was yesterday, right?
Yes.
To the question. But, I mean, how many words has he uttered on this issue? About 10 million? And, you know, he got that one wrong. He recovered quickly. He didn't dig a hole for himself and lie in it. I think it's been really, really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, but you may not be able to wade into this, but I will for a second. I have to say, I don't find it convincing, and it's maybe because I can't get the image of John Kerry. He described himself as the 27-year-old guy who testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for the first time. I don't know if you saw this piece, Brian McGorry, when Code Pink tried to interrupt the thing yesterday, and Kerry jumped in immediately and said, you know, I had those very same views when I did this at 27 years old. And when you when you see video and read what he said, you know, who can ask the a man be the last man to die for a mistake?
And don't forget Rand Paul's rejoinder to that,
which
too.
Was
how
great
can
line.
John Kerry now ask another young man to be the first man to die for a mistake? I thought that was a great line by Senator Paul.
You watch the 27-year-old thing, and then you think he voted for the Iraq resolution, which I continue to believe was because Bob Shrum told him you can't be elected president if you don't vote for it, even though you probably don't believe it. And then this, it's such a jumble of different people packed into one package that I, for one, find it hard to believe that his heart is.
Yeah,
really
but that's Jim. That's not unique to John Kerry. I mean, Matt Visor had an excellent story on the front page of Saturday's Globe, talking about how virtually every major player here.
Yeah, that's true.
Obama, yeah. Chuck Hagel. Yeah. Have been a real kind of bundle of contradictions here on this possible military action. Many of them have had very different views in the past in terms of whether it's Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, although not so much Afghanistan. But now that they're sitting in a different spot, it's almost like the situation dictates that they have different kinds of mindsets on this. It's been really fascinating to watch.
Hey, Brian, I have to plead guilty with our lead producer, Chelsea Murs, here to ethnic stereotypes, and we can end with this. Chelsea and I were discussing this morning whether we should bring up the death of the great poet Seamus Heaney with you. And Chelsea said, why don't we see if Brian wrote about Seamus Heaney when he was a columnist? And so she Googles Heaney and McGrory, and here's what she came up with. Brian McGrory, 41, stole multi-packs of Milky Bars along with Twix, Carmack, Chunky Kit Kats, and Toffee Crisps. When two police officers gave chase, McGrory started to hurl some of the chocolate bars at them, but the cops rugby tackled the crook and found more than 50 chocolate bars on him, worth 56 pounds. We have to ask the question, Brian, was that you?
I will deny being involved in this in any way. Which Brian McGrory is this? Is this in Ireland or is
yes,
it here?
Apparently it's in Ireland,
but that's...
There is a... I do know there's a Brian McGrory who's like a famous bartender in New York. And there's a Brian McGrory who is a really accomplished orthopedic surgeon in Portland, Maine.
Really?
There's also a chocolate thief, obviously, somewhere in Dublin. Hey, Brian, it's great to talk to you. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian McGrory is editor of the Boston Globe.
And he's with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. And I kind of missed him when he was gone. He was gone for a couple of weeks. He had the nerve to take vacation. But now he's back. And when we come back, the man people call the god of pop culture, Bob Thompson, joins us for a look at this year's TV season. Be forewarned, there are a few spoiler alerts. If you're not caught up on Mad Men, Breaking Bad, or Homeland, you're taking your TV viewing health into your own hands.
You know, Brian said there are a couple of Brian McGrorys he's aware of. This is Jim Browdy, who's a doctor in Atlanta, Georgia. And there's a guy who works at the front desk at a hotel in Sydney, Australia. So what do you think of that, Marjorie?
I think you spent a lot of time Googling yourself, Jim.
Bob Thompson's coming up.
People will say that I was turned into a terrorist, taught to hate my country. I love my country.
What if I told you I don't think he did it? I don't think Brody knew the bomb was in his car.
He's innocent.
I won't throw Carrie under the bus. She's unstable. But I'm on her side. I'll do anything.
Be still, my heart. This was a teaser for Homeland Season 3, which debuts in several weeks, 25 days to be exact, Marjorie, but who's counting? Joining us on the line to go over what shows we have to look forward to this season and what great shows we will mourn is Bob Thompson. Bob's the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Bob, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Bob. How are you? You should have seen Jim. He was vibrating when he was listening to that teaser for Homeland. So there's two shows that are going to be no more after the season. One, Jim is obsessed with. That's Breaking Bad. The other one is Mad Men. Let's start with Breaking Bad. You know, I have not been watching Breaking Bad, I must admit, Bob, but people are obsessed with this. Why does it have to end now?
Okay, well, first of all, if you haven't been watching it, you're very, very lucky, because the best way to watch this show is to get all of it, fill your freezer full of microwavable food. I've said this 100 times. Turn off the lights, turn off the phone, and just binge your way through the entire thing. It is by far up there with The Wire, The Sopranos, as one of the finest achievements of American television. And I think that can be said with no hyperbole whatsoever. It's really an exquisitely executed program. Why now? I mean, one of the reasons I think I like how television series have moved from the old network model that they do 22 episodes a year and they go on until they are so totally worn out that the wheels fall off.
That's so true.
I mean, by the time ER ended, I had a great ending, but it was just so worn out, and L.A. Law, all kinds of others. The new cable model, where all the exciting stuff is happening, have shorter seasons, 13 episodes usually, sometimes even less. They have much longer breaks, which can be very frustrating, but really gives time for these things to be made. And they tend to end when they're finished. A lot of these, The Wire went five brilliant episodes, and then they shut down and did something else. So the different business models of cable allow this, whereas network was all trying to get to at least 100 episodes and get a syndication package and hopefully further than that. I think Breaking Bad is going to be finished in after five seasons. I think it will have said what it has to say. The thing about the great thing about that story is it's called Breaking Bad. It's about a guy who goes bad, and you can go bad for five seasons, but once you get there, you've got to kind of wrap things up. And he's, of course, gotten there a long time ago.
Yeah, when you say worn out, I am worn out every week watching it. You can't breathe for 60 minutes. For those who haven't seen it, it's a story of it sounds so mundane. A chemistry professor turns meth kingpin. This clip is from the first episode of the final season of Breaking Bad. Walter White, who's Bryan Cranston, who's the lead, has figured out that his brother-in-law is on to him. Hank, the brother-in-law, knows that White is the famous meth cook. His name is Heisenberg. Here's the exchange that takes place between the two of them after Hank, the brother-in-law, tells Walter that he's going to take him down.
I'm a dying man who runs a car wash. My right hand to God, that is all that I am. What's the point?
This guy that bring the kids here. And then we'll talk.
That is not going to happen.
I don't know who you are. I don't even know who I'm talking.
That's true. If you don't know who I am, then maybe your best course would be to tread lightly.
Can I tell you something? Ooh. I can't even speak, Bob. Take it away. Say something.
Great.
Oh, my God. I mean, you know, there's in addition to the fact that there's almost never a wasted moment, at least in my opinion, in any of the shows, there is at least one scene a week that, to me, is amongst the classics, and that surely was one of them.
There is. That tread lightly, three syllables.
Yeah.
And the way those were uttered, be scarier than anybody in The Godfather. I'd rather wake up with a horse's head in my bed than next to Walter White. You're right. The photography is so beautiful. The composition, and not a single second wasted, as you pointed out. And it's also so literary. I mean, his name is Walter White. He gets discovered by his brother-in-law based on a clue he left in his bathroom, a book that he loved by Walt Whitman. And the Walt Whitman, Walt White comparisons weave through this for a long time. But what's so extraordinary and why those who haven't watched it yet are going to have such good fun watching it in big binges is that if you watch the pilot of this show, he is such a likable, normal normal guy. Yeah. I mean, he's teaching chemistry. He's got this son who's got some medical issues himself. He finds out he's got lung cancer, and he just wants to do everything to provide for his family, which makes perfect sense. And by the second episode, the body count is going up. He's dissolving bodies in bathtubs. I mean, he breaks bad so quickly. And by the second season, when he really becomes an evil character, that transformation seems to have been effortless, and it's such an interesting exploration how one can decide to do things for good reasons and completely go into the heart of darkness. I've always said if The Sopranos was about a very, very bad man who gets an offer at redemption and rejects it, Breaking Bad is about a very, very good man who gets an offer at damnation and he takes it in an instant.
You know, the thing you said a minute ago is so true about a lot of us who have college educations to pay. First thing we think about, can we open a meth lab? Can we, you know, one last thing, Bob, I've mentioned this on the air a couple of times, but not to you. People are so intimately involved in this series that the I can't think of the woman who plays the actress, the wife of Walter White in the show.
Right, right. Yeah.
Who wrote a piece in the New York Times a week or so ago about how hated she is in real life because how much people hate her and her husband in the show. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, we used to hear that about soap operas back in the day.
Yeah.
You know, the villains would get accosted in the a grocery store. Yeah. And let's face it, the daytime soap opera is dying its last gasp, and its replacement now are these incredible serials on cable.
We're talking with Bob Thompson of Syracuse University about the fall lineup. So I asked you about Breaking Bad, why that has to end now, and you explained that, you know, these series on cable are different than ones on network. But is that true? You know, Mad Men is not on cable, really. It's on, what is it, on AMC?
AMC, yeah.
AMC, which is a basic cable. It's not premium cable,
okay.
But it is basic cable.
But it's ending now, too. A lot of it's going to be crushed.
Right. I mean, it's been, it got out of the gate awful strong. It won best Emmy, or Emmy for best drama for at least the first three seasons. And it's, of course, gone on longer than Breaking Bad. But also, I think it's also a program, if artistically, that is certainly ready to go. A lot of people have complained about this season. I actually thought it was a very, very interesting season. But I guess if nothing else, the way this was worked out chronologically, it starts in the early 60s, which, you know, we're no longer in the Eisenhower era, but it
right.
seems like a lot of the people are still living in it. But it's in the 60s, but when the 60s were still the 50s. And now we've, of course, seen it emerge as the 60s and all of the cultural cataclysm and everything happened. And watching all of these characters make that transformation. You know, I just thought of this right now. It's kind of like Breaking Bad. We watch Walt go from one kind of person to a completely different kind. In Mad Men, we've watched the world that these people live in go from yeah. one kind of
yes.
world to a completely different one.
You know, speaking of that, for people who haven't seen this or want to reminisce, this is the last episode in season 6 of Mad Men. In this scene, Don Draper, played by the great John Hamm, has just successfully pitched an ad to Hershey. Don bases it on his own sugar-coated remembrance of how his dad used to buy him a Hershey bar. But then, in this conference room, out of nowhere, Don Draper, John Hamm, says this.
I'm sorry. I have to say this. I don't know if I'll ever see you again.
What?
I was an orphan. I grew up in Pennsylvania. In a whorehouse. I read about Milton Hershey and his school in Coronet magazine or some other crap the girls left by the toilet. And I read that some orphans had a different life there. I could picture it. I dreamt of it. Of being wanted. Because the woman who was forced to raise me would look at me every day like she'd hoped I would disappear.
And Bob Thompson, some people didn't like that scene. I thought that was one of the great scenes of the whole Mad Men series. I loved it. Is that what people were complaining about, Don Draper finally kind of letting it all hang out there?
Well, I think by the time this time, people are so invested in the show that if it doesn't go exactly the way, you know, they now think in some ways that they're kind of creating it. And who knows? I mean, there are lots of different kind of complaints. I'm with you, though, on this, that that was a beautiful scene and so dense. I mean, you could write a doctoral dissertation on that single scene. As a matter of fact, I'm sure there are people right now doing just that. all that, you know, you start out with the chocolate, and as you you pointed out in the, when you were introducing the scene, that the sugar-coated nature of things, and all of a sudden the magic Hersheyland notion changes into something so much more horrible. And then just those little sentences. I read it in Coronet magazine or some other crap that the girls did by the toilet. That sentence is just exquisite.
So other than, I hate to even move on because John Hamm is one of my favorites and that's Mad Men's one of my favorite shows as well. Is there anything else we should be mourning that's about to pass on TV this season, Bob?
Well, I guess Homeland is passing, but I don't think that's till later 2014. They have a whole other season coming, don't they? Or
yeah, they do. And, you know, I did a little research. I bet you don't even know this. On the night of September 29th at 9 p.m., the finale of Breaking Bad is on at the exact same time that the first episode of Homeland is on for what a night. Oh, my goodness.
I'm trying to remember. I believe it was Moonlighting and Family Ties that were the final episodes were up against each other. I think it was those two. Family Ties went 10 minutes over so they could all come out and bow to the audience and go out of character. And, you know, we're talking now in a time where you had to set your VCRs if you wanted to make sure you saw both of these. Now, of course, most people who have got Homeland and Breaking Bad have probably got a DVR to solve that problem with. And the big question is, which one do you watch live and which one do you watch?
It is huge. You know, Bob, speaking of Homeland, Marjorie and I did an hour-long interview with Elizabeth Warren when she was running against Scott Brown a couple of years ago. And one of the ways I was sure I could trip her up, I said to Marjorie in advance, is I'm going to ask her what her favorite television show that isn't on PBS, and I know she won't have one, without missing a beat. She said Homeland, as did Barack Obama in some interview a couple of years.
I remember that.
I mean, what's your take? I'm a huge fan of this, too. We happen to be talking about three shows I love. What's your take on Homeland?
I thought the first two seasons were like a snowball going down a mountain. I mean, they were the inertia, the energy, the locomotive quality of those first two seasons. I think we're really extraordinary. Who would have thought that you could have a show that moved faster and more frenetically than like 24 or one of those kinds of things? And it did, but not so much necessarily on the action level as on this kind of psychological locomotion sort of thing. And then I think once they, you know, you got that idea of knowing whether he was guilty or not and knowing who he really
was. We should
was.
Say, let me interrupt you, Bob Thompson, and say for those who haven't seen it, this is about a war hero returned home after, I think, 8 years or something in captivity at turned terrorist. And Claire Danes is the woman at the CIA who is bound to get to the bottom of this. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. And she's in love with two things. One, getting to the bottom of it. And then two, getting to the bottom of him. Well, I mean, it's very complicated. Anyway, those first two seasons, that's all working out, this weird notion of what's good and what's bad. And it really was one of those shows that kind of messes with your whole ethos. And then, I don't know, I'm going to be really interested to see this coming season, because as that show began to progress, it seemed to kind of lose that intense focus that it had before. And here's another example of sometimes when you've got a story to tell, you get to a place where you're done telling the story. And an awful lot of times, as we talked about before, the mandate is it's a big hit, so we're going to keep telling it. And then you've got to kind of make up ways for it to keep going. It'd be like if Moby Dick had come out and been a big hit. It wasn't, but and they'd have said, "Oh, Herman, that was a great story. Can you give us 100 more chapters?"
Yeah.
And then, of course, the whale would have to come back and destroy another ship, and it would eventually get to be old.
Yeah, I think we saw that in the remakes of Jaws. It never quite captured the first Jaws did it. So, what's coming up this season that we should be really excited about, Bob Thompson?
Well, I guess we could talk about things that we could be excited about. We could also talk about things, interestingly, that we shouldn't necessarily be excited about.
Okay.
I'm shocked at the number of comedy cliches that have come back. And the cliche now is parents moving back in with their kids. Now, I may not be able to remember these all exactly, but back in the game on ABC, mom and son come move in with their crotchety father, played by James Caan. Dad, Seth MacFarlane, live action, not an animated this time, where two best friends and business partners, their dads each move in with them. Mom, recovering single mom's own mother, who's got her own issues, moves back in with her. Sean saves the world. Sean Hayes, divorced dad, overbearing mom, comes back. And the Millers. Mom moves in with one of the brothers, and dad moves in with the other. I mean, I can't put my finger why this is the season with parents moving back into.
It's a bad economy, Bob. That's what
it is. Yeah.
Hey, but you know, speaking of comedies, we've just discussed three very serious shows: Homeland, Breaking Bad, and Mad Men. Is there a great comedy on? I have to say, when I watch some of the things that have been on for years, and I don't see many of them, when I see them with even some still with laugh tracks, I cannot believe how juvenile and pathetic the humor is. Is there a great comedy show either continuing or about to be unveiled?
Well, it's interesting because the real quality explosion that's happened on cable has been drama.
Yeah.
We talk about all the great shows. However, if you go back a little ways, that wasn't necessarily the case. Cable had its the Gary Shandling it's Gary Shandling show. Plays a late night talk show.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on it for now. That was a really good the Larry Sanders Show.
Yeah.
We had Curb Your Enthusiasm, which was kind of the Seinfeld sequel in an odd sort of a way. That was an extraordinary comedy. Now there are comedies on cable, but none that we talk about with the same kind of energy that we do with the dramas.
Because they're not that good?
I would say probably the most exciting comedy going on is what Comedy Central is doing from 11 to midnight.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's also pretty funny, though. You mentioned Larry David and obviously of Seinfeld fame and then Curb Your Enthusiasm and then the HBO movie that is essentially was Curb Your Enthusiasm, the sequel coming out late this summer. I think Veep, I don't know if it's coming back, Veep with Julia Louis-Dreyfus is actually, it's a half-hour comedy about the vice president of the United States played by her. I think it's a pretty funny show.
I do, too. That show is crawling with Syracuse University alums.
Is that so?
At the beginning of each season, they come and show us a couple of episodes before it plays.
That's great.
It gets a very big response among college-age students, which is hard to do, but very desirable demographic, especially if it had advertising, which it doesn't. So, yeah, I think that's been a show kind of quietly going along, and I think it's very fun.
So anything else that's starting that we should be on the lookout for?
Well, interestingly enough, it's like we're back to the 70s and 80s in some cases. Both Robin Williams and Michael J. Fox back, and this is on Network. Robin Williams' show, what's it called, The Crazy Ones, takes place in an ad agency, echoes of Mad Men, but it's a comedy. That's not too exciting. The Michael J. Fox show is... I think looks a lot more interesting, although based on single episodes, it's really hard to tell. And even Ironside is coming back. If you're old enough to remember ye olden days when that was on.
Raymond Burr, the lawyer in a wheelchair? Is that what Ironside? Or the detective or something?
Exactly. And Blair Underwood is going to take Burr's place on that. And then if you like fantasy, you are in for a season. NBC's got... Dracula, Sleepy Hollow on Fox, Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on ABC, Once Upon a Time in Wonderland. I like that, Once Upon a Time. So that's been interesting. That's ABC. CW's got The Originals, The Tomorrow People. Fox has got Almost Human, where human cops pair up with robot-like cops. And if you can't get enough of Downton Abbey, CW also has Rain, following the life of the really fabulous-looking Mary Queen of Scots.
Really? I didn't know she was fabulous-looking. There we go.
Hey, Bob.
I didn't either, but...
Now you know.
Yes, she was.
Now, Bob Thompson, let's end with the unfairest of questions, but it just popped into my head. The television gods tell Bob Thompson, one of the gods of television, that you can only watch one thing this fall. What's the one thing that you choose?
Wow, that's a tough one. I'm not going to count Breaking Bad because it's almost over.
Yeah, 3 weeks, 4 weeks.
I think I'd have to go with the new season of Homeland.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Okay.
My day. Bob
We're all
Thompson,
excited.
Thanks,
Jim's going to make
always.
A big decision on the 29th. What's he going to do? Which one is he going to watch? Bob Thompson, thanks again. Bob Thompson's director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. Always fun to talk to you, Bob.
Thank you for having me.
Speak to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we remember the great Irish poet Seamus Heaney with Christopher Lydon, and we'll talk to Charlie Baker, who's just announced he's running for the governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We're also going to talk to the new head of Friendly's Ice Cream.
About that.
I am too. He's going to tell us how he's going to fix the beloved Friendly's.
Did you go to Friendly's when you were a kid?
Are you kidding? A big beef cheeseburger special and a vanilla fribble all the time. Absolutely.
I guess the answer is yes.
Yeah, I did. I still love fribbles. Anyway, our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Thanks for listening. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
See you tomorrow.